The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second week reading from the December 25th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. Last week we took our regular articles, and this week we'll pick up some of the review articles for the year and a few other odds and ends. So we'll start with the year in review. January. A year of bloodshed and terror begins in Paris, where two Islamic gunmen storm the offices of Charlie Hebdo, a satirical magazine that has published cartoons mocking the Prophet Muhammad. They shoot dead 11 employees, including most of the editorial staff, and also kill a policeman while making their getaway. The killers, French-born brothers Sharif and Saeed Kaouchi, are later killed themselves in a shootout with police. In Washington, D.C., President Barack Obama enters the penultimate year of his presidency while a new Congress is sworn in. After a sweeping victory in last year's midterm elections, the Republican Party controls both the House and Senate for the first time in 8 years and already has its eye on the White House. Though the first primaries for 2016 general election are still a year away, more than a dozen Republicans are considering a run. The presumptive frontrunner is Jeb Bush, son and brother of two former presidents who has amassed a huge campaign war chest. In New York, real estate billionaire and TV personality Donald Trump declines to renew his contract with NBC for hosting The Apprentice, indicating that he has other plans. February. President Obama asks Congress for a formal authorization for the use of military force against the self-declared Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, saying it's time to give troops the clear strategy and the support they need to get the job done. But he gets little backing in either party. Democrats fear that the authorization is too open-ended and could lead to mission creep and other Middle East quagmire, while Republicans say they don't want to rule out ground troops. NBC suspends news anchor Brian Williams for 6 months after he is found to have exaggerated accounts of the dangers he faced while covering the war in Iraq and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. "I told stories that were not true over the years," William later admits. "I never intended to. It got mixed up." March. A German Wings Airbus A320 flies into a mountain in the French Alps, killing all 150 on board. Flight and voice recorders later suggest that co-pilot Andreas Lubitz, 27, crashed the plane on the purpose for after locking the pilot out of the cockpit. Lubitz, it turned out, was being treated for suicidal depression and had told an ex-girlfriend that one day he'd do something to make everyone remember him. At the invitation of House Speaker John Boehner and to the irritation of the White House, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses Congress, warning that President Obama's proposal to curtail Iran's nuclear program in return for lifting economic sanctions would be a very bad deal. Senator Ted Cruz becomes the first candidate of either party to formally announce that he's running for president. The Democratic presidential frontrunner, Hillary Clinton, faces a congressional inquiry after it emerges that she used a private email account, run from a computer server in her home, during her time as Secretary of State. Clinton admits that she's deleted about 30,000 emails that she and her lawyer deemed personal, and says she set up the private server to spare herself the inconvenience of using more than one email account. "I thought using one device would be simpler," says Clinton, and obviously, it hasn't worked out that way. April. Hillary Clinton formally announces her presidential bid, followed a day later by Republican Florida Senator Marco Rubio. In Baltimore, police arrest Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man, and throw him handcuffed in the back of a police van. During the ride to the police station, Gray sustains grave injuries to his spine and neck, and he later dies. Gray's death becomes a rallying point for the Black Lives Matter movement that has been protesting police brutality since 2014 and sparks weeks of demonstrations in Baltimore that turn into riots. President Obama condemns the riots as criminals and the rioters as criminals and thugs, but also calls Gray's death part of a slow-rolling crisis that has been going on for a long time. The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. May. In a televised interview with Diane Sawyer, Olympic legend Bruce Jenner confirms that he is transgender and will henceforth be known as Caitlin. In a national referendum, 62% of Irish voters choose to make gay marriage legal. In Texas, two Islamist gunmen are shot dead as they try to attack an anti-Muslim Draw Muhammad cartoon contest. In Boston, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev is sentenced to his death for his role in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. June. In New York, billionaire Donald Trump formally declares himself a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. His slogan, "Make America Great Again." Trump promises to build a wall across the entire 1,900-mile Mexican border and make Mexico pay for it. In Charleston, South Carolina, a young white supremacist, Dylan Roof, murders 9 black worshipers at Emmanuel AME, a historical black church. Roof later tells police he'd hoped his actions would ignite a race war. Instead, the massacre creates a groundswell of public opinion against displays of the Confederate battle flag, which Roof wore as a symbol of white pride. The governors of several southern states order the flag removed from their state capitals. In a stirring eulogy for the Reverend Clemata Pinckney, one of those killed in the church, President Obama lauds the community for coming together after the tragedy, before leading the crowd and singing Amazing Grace. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court rules that state-level bans on same-sex marriage violate the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection and due process. Gay marriage is now legal across all 50 states. July. After nearly a decade of diplomacy and nearly 2 years of intense negotiation, diplomats reached a deal with Iran to curtail its nuclear program. The proposed deal would limit Iran's ability to enrich uranium for 15 years, under strict monitoring by international observers. In return for a lifting of economic sanctions, jubilant crowds dance down the streets in Tehran, and President Obama hails the deal as a chance for Iran to move in a new direction. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls it a mistake of historic proportions. Donald Trump's freewheeling campaign for president, meanwhile, runs into fresh controversy after Senator John McCain criticizes his stance on immigration. Trump says of the former GOP nominee, who was tortured and held captive for 5.5 years during the Vietnam War, "He's not a war hero. I like people who weren't captured." August. The FBI launches a probe into Hillary Clinton's emails after investigators determine that some messages sent from her private account contained classified information. Clinton hands over her now infamous email server to the agency for analysis. Polls show Clinton's unfavorable rating at a daunting 53%. In the early primary state of New Hampshire, she falls into second place behind Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, whose populist rhetoric has energized the Democratic base. Vice President Joe Biden meets with Democratic fundraisers, sparking speculation that he may challenge Clinton for the nomination. Republicans in Congress vote to defund Planned Parenthood after videos surface showing staffers discussing the harvesting of body parts from aborted fetuses. Donald Trump continues to surge in the polls, and he dominates the Republican debate in Cleveland. After Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly questions Trump in the debate about his Republican credentials and about calling women fat pigs and disgusting animals, Trump accuses her of coming after him so aggressively, it was as if there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of wherever. The ensuing outrage fails to slow Trump's momentum. September. Kim Davis, a county clerk in rural Kentucky, spends 5 days in jail for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. "The main authority that rules my life is the Lord," said Davis, who is on her fourth marriage. Davis is released when she agrees not to stop her clerks from issuing the licenses instead. Pope Francis makes his first official visit to the U.S., dismaying conservatives with politically charged remarks on climate change, immigration policy, and economic inequality. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, a Catholic, boycotts the Pope's address to Congress, saying he sounds like a leftist politician. In Europe, the stream of refugees fleeing Syria's civil war becomes a flood, forcing governments to decide whether or not to accept refugees for resettlement and how many. Russian President Vladimir Putin announces he's sending fighter jets, artillery, and troops to Syria to fight the terrorist, trying to topple dictator Bashar al-Assad. Jeb Bush's poll numbers slide into the single digits after a string of lackluster debate performances and relentless mockery from Donald Trump, who insists Bush is too low energy to be president. In a rally in Dallas, Trump declares that as president, he'll deport all 11.5 illegal immigrants and is greeted by a standing ovation and shouts of USA, USA. October. At the first Democratic debate, Hillary Clinton turns in a polished performance that settles the nerves of her supporters. The best moment of the night actually comes from Senator Bernie Sanders, who exclaims, "The country is sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails." Clinton's rebound continues in Washington, where she easily fends off an 11-hour grilling by House Republicans investigating the 2012 Benghazi attacks. And Joe Biden announces that he's decided not to run for president. Tired of fighting the House's Tea Party wing, Speaker John Boehner abruptly announces his retirement. As one of his final acts, Boehner strikes a spending deal with the White House, ending a threat by some conservative Republicans to shut down the government unless Planned Parenthood is defunded. With some reluctance, Representative Paul Ryan replaces Boehner as Speaker. At Umpqua Community College in Oregon, a gunman enters a classroom and shoots 9 students dead before committing suicide. A frustrated President Obama calls on the nation to support sensible gun control laws. "This is a political choice that we make to allow this to happen," Obama says. November. Vladimir Putin escalates his military involvement in Syria and bombs ISIS-held areas after the Islamic extremists claim responsibility for downing a Russian airliner in Egypt. In Paris, a team of at least 9 ISIS-affiliated jihadis armed with AK-47s and suicide vests attack multiple locations around the city, including restaurants, a soccer stadium, and a concert hall, killing 130 civilians. President Francois Hollande vows a merciless response and orders airstrikes against ISIS targets in Syria. Donald Trump declares that to prevent Paris-style attacks in the U.S., he'd consider requiring all Muslims to register with authorities. We're going to have to do certain things that were frankly unthinkable a year ago, Trump says. At a Planned Parenthood facility in Colorado, a gunman kills three people and wounds nine, later telling police, "No more baby parts." December. A radicalized Muslim couple, Saeed Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, leave their six-month-old daughter with Farouk's mother, arm themselves with assault rifles and pipe bombs, and kill 14 of Farouk's co-workers at a holiday party in San Bernardino, California. The couple are later shot dead in a gun battle with police. It's the deadliest act of terrorism on U.S. soil since 9/11. Donald Trump calls for a total and complete shutdown on Muslims entering the U.S., and his national poll lead surges, with the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary just weeks away. In Paris, 195 nations agree to a landmark accord to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions so as to slow the pace of climate change. "I believe this moment can be a turning point for the world," Obama said, calling the agreement the best chance we have to save the one planet we've got. Here is a compilation of some of the poll watch shorts we had through the year. They say the way we were in 2015, we fear terrorism and worry about the state of the economy, but hope for divine intervention for our football teams. It's divided into some categories. First of all, how are we feeling? Pretty dismal. 69% of Americans think the nation is on the wrong track, the most pessimistic we've been in 4 years. And 72% believe the country isn't as great as it once was. 59% believe the economy is doing poorly, with 47% saying their family is only scraping by, making enough to pay bills and obligations. So whom do we blame for our problems? Washington politicians, mostly. 54% don't like President Obama's handling of the economy, and 59% think he's dealt poorly with foreign policy. We're also not that keen on government's other branches. A record 50% disapprove of the Supreme Court's recent actions, and 86% have an unfavorable opinion of Congress. Indeed, 55% think ordinary Americans could do a better job of dealing with the nation's woes than our current elected officials. How has society changed? In some ways, we're more accepting. A record 61% now support same-sex marriage. 61% say it's morally acceptable to have a baby out of wedlock. And 58% think marijuana use should be legal. But religious intolerance is rising. 57% don't like the idea of a Muslim becoming president. And 56% believe Islam isn't compatible with traditional American values, up from 47% in 2011. What do we do for fun? Kick back and watch a football game. 50% of Americans follow the NFL more than keep up with any other pro sport. For a lot of fans, watching sports is a religious experience. 26% believe God plays a role in deciding which team will win a game. And 53% say the Almighty rewards athletes who have faith with good health and success. Despite our love for sports on TV, 28% of Americans say they didn't engage in any exercise or physical activity over the past year, the highest percentage since 2007. And finally, what are we afraid of? A lot. 83% of voters fear there will be large-scale terrorist attack in the U.S. in the near future. And 60% think it's likely that terrorists are living in their hometown. 63% are worried that they or an acquaintance could be the victim of gun violence. And 40% personally know someone who was fatally shot or committed suicide with a firearm. 45% fear that the federal government could use a military exercise to covertly seize control of some states. And 44% think the machines with artificial intelligence could wipe out the human race. Sadly, many Americans can't even shake off their worries and relax at the beach. 38% are afraid a shark will eat them when they take a dip in the ocean. The health and science summary for the year is broken into three sections. Some of the things they said were good for us, and some of the things we were told to avoid. But we'll start with the big scientific breakthroughs of 2015. A billion Earths. The Milky Way is home to about 1 billion rocky planets similar to Earth, NASA now estimates. A survey of Kepler Space Telescope found the galaxy is teeming with planets, many of them in the so-called Goldilocks zone, where temperatures are suitable to life. NASA says there are about 14 billion potentially habitable worlds, but only 1 billion of these planets are truly Earth-like, orbiting stars similar to the Sun. Mind-controlled bionic hands. Three Austrian men involved in traumatic accidents this year became the first patients to undergo bionic reconstruction, receiving mind-controlled robotic hands. The high-tech appendages are equipped with sensors that respond to electrical impulses generated by muscles transplanted from the men's legs to their arms. The prosthetics restored the men's manual function, enabling them to complete tasks that were previously impossible, such as pouring water and buttoning a shirt. Pluto's bizarre landscape. Pluto was once just a mysterious pinpoint of light in space, but this year NASA's New Horizons spacecraft gave stargazers their first close-up views of the distant dwarf planet. Those who anticipated a pockmarked frozen world have been mystified by bizarre images of high peaks, ice volcanoes, and glaciers that appear to be floating on a pool of frozen nitrogen. Nothing like this has ever been seen in our outer solar system. A new super antibiotic. As the number of drug-resistant superbugs grows, bacteriologists have struggled desperately to find new antibiotics to fight them. But an experimental antibiotic called Texobactin could be a game changer. Researchers at Northeastern University discovered the drug by targeting a vast, untapped supply of soil bacteria. Using a device called an iChip, they tricked bacteria into growing in a lab by mimicking the microbe's natural environment. Texobactin is exquisitely active against some very hard-to-deal-with bugs, says study author Kim Lewis. The drug has safely treated mice with drug-resistant infections, but human trials are still likely 2 years away. So, some of the things they said were good for us. Nature walks can make you healthier and happier by driving out obsessive negative thoughts. A Stanford University study found that strolling in a natural setting decreases activity in the subgingival prefrontal cortex, a brain region particularly active during rumination. It was pretty striking that a 90-minute walk had as much of an impact, said author Gregory Batman. For people with a tendency to brood, Interrupting an endless stream of negative thoughts reduces the risk for depression and other mental illness. Green spaces may also make kids smarter. A separate study of roughly 2,600 fourth graders in Barcelona found that those with greater exposure to nature were more attentive and experienced a 5% increase in working memory. A glass of wine each day could improve heart health and blood sugar control among people with type 2 diabetes. A study in Israel suggested that if you suffer from the condition and incorporate a moderate amount of red wine into a heart-healthy diet, it may boost good cholesterol levels by 10%. Red varietals are also rich in beneficial compounds that are linked to fewer symptoms of metabolic syndrome, a group of factors that raise the risk for heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. What's more, a daily glass of red or white wine may improve the metabolism of type 2 diabetics who absorb alcohol more slowly than others. Those patients who drink wine in moderation can continue to do so, says study author, and with the knowledge that it is safe and likely beneficial. Daily aspirin may help prevent colon cancer. People in their 50s with at least a 10% risk of developing cardiovascular disease over the next decade should take a low dose of aspirin to protect against heart attacks and colorectal cancer, a government task force recommends. Aspirin therapy isn't recommended for everyone because regular use of the drug increases the risk for internal bleeding. But for people in these specific groups, the benefits outweigh the potential harms. Uninterrupted sleep may help ward off Alzheimer's disease. A study involving some 2,500 older people showed that on average, subjects who slept fitfully or suffered from sleep apnea developed mild cognitive impairment about 10 years earlier than sound sleepers. Researchers also found a lack of deep sleep may fuel the toxic accumulation of a sticky protein called amyloid beta in the brain, a hallmark of the degenerative memory-robbing disease. Sleep, says author Bryce Mander, appears to be a missing piece of the Alzheimer's puzzle. And some of the things we were told to avoid. Sitting may be worse for us than smoking. A study revealed that remaining sedentary for extended periods can dramatically increase the risk for chronic health issues, including heart disease, diabetes, and depression. Not only that, but the negative effects of prolonged sitting aren't offset by intense exercise before or after work. People with desk jobs should be on their feet for at least 2 hours daily, either by taking occasional strolls or using a standing desk. We are creatures of habit, says co-author Gavin Bradley, and we have come to the wrong conclusion that sitting is the optimum way of conducting office work. Speaking of work, shift work can be unhealthy, increasing the risk of heart disease, obesity, and metabolic disorders. Researchers in Finland tracked airline employees and found that people who worked nights or irregular hours slept less than peers who were scheduled for the regular business day. Beyond that, it seems that shift work itself strongly affects workers' eating habits, says study leader Katri Hemio, noting that they ate fewer vegetables and consumed more fat. One way to address the problem, experts say, is to stock workplace vending machines with healthier foods and provide refrigerators so employees can bring healthier meals from home. Dietary supplements can land you in the hospital. They're responsible for at least 23,000 emergency room trips and 2,100 hospital admissions in the U.S. every year, a study found, suggesting those loosely regulated, quote, natural substances aren't always safe. After analyzing 10 years of data, researchers established that 65% of these ER visits were prompted by chest pain, palpitations, and dizziness. The worst offenders were herbal formulas promising to accelerate weight loss, boost energy, or enhance sex drive, all of which were laced with stimulants. Many Americans take dietary supplements in an effort to stay healthy, says author Andrew Geller of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but these products can cause harm. Loneliness increases the risk of death by up to 14%, a University of Chicago study found. The stressful pangs of unwanted solitude trigger the flight or fight response, causing inflammation and cellular changes that disrupt the production of white blood cells that protect the body from illness. Social isolation does improve the body's ability to fight harmful bacteria, but it also makes people more susceptible to viral infections. The lonelier one is, and the longer one is lonely, author Joe Cacioppo says, the greater the negative effects. On the Talking Points page, Chipotle, the downside of natural. Can Chipotle recover from food poisoning, asks James Surowiecki in NewYorker.com. Arguably the country's single most successful restaurant chain, the company is reeling from a series of food poisoning outbreaks that have caused its stock to plummet 25%. In November, Chipotle shut down 43 of its Mexican eateries in Oregon and Washington, and in ensuing weeks, customers from seven other states contracted foodborne illnesses. The latest debacle came last week when at least 120 Boston College students who ate at Chipotle caught a highly contagious norovirus, a nasty stomach bug that causes explosive vomiting and diarrhea. The company touts its use of fresh, often locally sourced ingredients for its tacos and burritos, which is part of the problem. Dealing with many smaller organic local suppliers rather than a few large ones makes the task of ensuring food safety more complex. In light of recent events, it also makes Chipotle's slogan, "Food with Integrity," sound painfully ironic. Perhaps the company was too focused on creating the illusion of safety, said Kimberly Leonard in USNews.com. Chipotle boasts that its food is free of genetically modified organisms, which is fine, except that scientists say that GMOs pose no known threat to humans. Better to focus on the E. coli, salmonella, and other potentially dangerous microbes in lettuce, tomatoes, and cilantro, which can make people sick. The company's comeuppance is well-deserved, said Henry Miller in Forbes.com. In all its self-congratulatory new aginess, Chipotle eschews high-tech pesticides and rejects modern synthetic fertilizers. But food produced with modern techniques is actually safer than food that reflects pandering to current fads. Chipotle's negligence made people sick, and it needs new management. Let's see if there's a company left after the trial lawyers get through with it. Chipotle's situation could be worse, said Timothy Lee in Vox.com. In 1993, a massive E. coli outbreak caused by undercooked hamburgers at Jack in the Box sickened hundreds of people and killed four children. The fast food chain survived by implementing innovative new food safety procedures and running clever ads showing the dynamiting of the company's headquarters. Chipotle is going to have to pursue the same two-pronged strategy: identify and fix problems, and make sure the public knows the company has turned over a new leaf when it comes to food safety. Islamic extremism, the assimilation problem. Why do Western Muslims become radicalized? After the terrorist attacks by European-born Muslims in Paris and American-born Saeed Fouk in San Bernardino, California, that's a question that we cannot afford to ignore, said Victor Davis Hansen in NationalReview.com. Part of the answer surely lies in the future of many Muslims to assimilate, in the failure of many Muslims to assimilate. Islamic immigrants to the West often see their new countries as an oasis, modern, safe, and prosperous lands where no tyrant will drag them off to jail. But their children often feel no such gratitude. Conflicted about the permissive culture in which they grow up, and exposed to fundamentalist anti-Western preaching in mosques, these children of immigrants can be tempted by the lure of Islamic purity. That leads to a rejection of the sinful nation in which they were born, and a fanatical embrace of their religious identity. As a British citizen who was radicalized for more than a decade, I know exactly how that process works, said Majid Nawaz in the Wall Street Journal. Terrorist groups like ISIS try to eliminate the gray zones between Islamist theocrats and anti-Muslim bigots, and force individuals to pick sides. That strategy is working. In Britain, a survey found that a quarter of Muslims sympathized with the Charlie Hebdo shootings in Paris. Over 1,000 British Muslims have joined ISIS, more than have joined the British Army Reserves. Muslim leaders and liberal commentators who insist Islamist radicals have nothing to do with Islam are essentially saying there's nothing to discuss here. That's plainly not the case. The U.S. is much better at assimilation than Europe, said Hisham Melhem in Politico.com. Most American Muslims are middle class and well integrated into our society. And yet, plainly, America is not immune. Farouk's murderous rampage was preceded by Army Major Nidal Hassan's slaying of 13 people at Fort Hood and the Boston Marathon bombing, perpetrated by the Tsarnaev brothers. Demonizing all Muslims for those isolated acts only plays into ISIS's hands. But the Muslim community does have a responsibility to engage in honest self-examination. As Christians and Jews have done, Muslims must accept that their sacred texts and traditions can and should be critically and rationally examined, criticized, and revised. If Muslims in the West do not adapt their faith to modern liberal values, they will never feel at home in their adopted countries, and the war will go on forever. Trump, why he's the GOP's worst nightmare. For Republicans, 2016 is becoming the campaign from hell, said Brent Badowski in TheHill.com. 2 months away from the Iowa caucuses, the party's presidential frontrunner is still Donald Trump, a man increasingly compared to Adolf Hitler because of his racist proposals to ban Muslims from entering the country and to round up and deport 11.5 million illegal immigrants. On the strength of his Muslim bashing, Trump soared this week to a new high of 41% in national polls of Republicans. Party leaders are in full panic mode, fearing that a Trump nomination would lead to a Goldwater-like landslide defeat to Democratic Hillary Clinton in the general election. The damage from a Trump nomination could extend beyond 2016, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. Nominating Trump would fundamentally alter the ideological character of the Republican Party. Since Ronald Reagan, Republican nominees have been broadly internationalist in outlook, favoring free trade, free markets, and immigration, and strong American leadership on the global stage. But under Trump's nationalistic, xenophobic leadership, the GOP would embrace a Fortress America approach to the international relations, with closed borders and trade wars. The future of the GOP as we know it is in question. Establishment Republicans created this monster, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. For decades, the GOP has exploited the cultural and racial resentments of white voters to win elections. Once in power, Republicans have turned their backs on these disaffected voters while focusing on serving the interests of a small, wealthy economic elite. Just when the GOP's base's anger is peaking over this betrayal, along comes Donald Trump, saying bluntly the things establishment candidates try to convey in coded deniable hints. President Obama has to share some of the blame, though, says Ross Douthat, also in the New York Times. Many of the fears motivating Trump supporters are entirely reasonable, including the anxiety over radical Islam and the global wave of attacks that have killed hundreds of people from Cairo to California. When one of the San Bernardino terrorists easily entered the U.S. on a visa, despite her radicalization, you need not be a knuckle-dragging bigot to worry about refugees and other immigrants from the Islamic world. Obama should have acknowledged the legitimacy of these concerns, but has offered only lectures on tolerance and vague reassurances that ISIS will be defeated, leaving a void that Trump has filled. The economic misery of the middle class has also fueled Donald Trump's rise, said Dan Bouts in the Washington Post. In the 1970s, middle-income households represented 61% of the nation's population. Today, thanks in part to the Great Recession, they no longer make up a majority. Many of the people hit hardest are white, have no more than a high school education, and feel increasingly threatened by rapid demographic and cultural changes. Trump promises not just to make America great, but to make America great again, to take the country back to a time when average Americans were economically secure and white people made up a higher share of the population. To stop the nightmare of a Trump nomination, said Jim Newell in Slate.com, GOP leaders are now reportedly discussing the unthinkable, a brokered convention. If Trump comes into July's convention with less than a 50% majority, the party could block his nomination by pressuring delegates to pick a more palatable candidate, such as Senator Ted Cruz or Senator Marco Rubio. The sight of Republicans squabbling on the convention floor, however, would be an unholy PR mess, and it would mean calling Trump on his threat to run as an independent. That probably won't be necessary, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. Trump supporters are largely older, less wealthy, and less educated. In other words, not the kind of people who typically turn up at the Iowa caucuses on a cold February night to express their preferences in public. If he loses in Iowa and polls show Cruz surging past him there, his aura of Superman invulnerability will fade. Iowa could be Trump's kryptonite. All the evidence before our eyes tells us that most Americans will reject Trumpism, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. Even if he's supported by 40% of Republicans, the brash businessman commands just 14% of the general electorate. But as with the unprecedented surge of far-right parties in Europe, Trump's rise stands as a warning that traditional politics isn't working and that a middle class filled with economic and cultural grievances is losing patience with the status quo. Trump is a containable menace. He is also a wake-up call. We don't often get to the book reviews, but I thought I would offer you at least the top critics' choice for the nonfiction and fiction work for 2015. In the nonfiction category, at number one, they have Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, published by Spiegel and Grau. Ta-Nehisi Coates' landmark book issued an essential clarion call to our collective conscience, said Pamela Newkirk in the San Francisco Chronicle. Presented as an open letter by Coates, an open letter to Coates' 15-year-old son, Between the World and Me is in part a survival guide for living as a black man in America. But it is above all a blistering critique of the injustices inflicted on the nations marginalized by a majority culture too ready to believe in feel-good myths. Coates, a Baltimore native who now writes for The Atlantic, begins by describing the choking effects of coming of age in an impoverished community warped by a constant fear of violence at the hands of the police. But from start to finish, his extended essay makes the effects of racism visceral, said Thomas Chatterson Williams in the Washington Post. Rarely does a book come along that delivers all this in one. This one does. A mature writer, entirely consumed by a momentous subject and working at the extreme of his considerable powers, when a national events most conform to his vision. In a dissent, Coates offers no hope for a solution to the institutional racism he describes, says Jesse McCarthy in The Nation. And the number one story from the fiction category, The Story of the Lost Child by Elena Ferrante, published by Europa. Elena Ferrante's latest work completes a quartet of novels that just might rank as the greatest achievement of fiction in the post-war era, says Charles Finch in the Chicago Tribune. The Italian author, who writes under a pen name, has brought such honesty and insight to her portrayal of a profound, decades-long friendship between two women from a Naples slum that the experience of reading the books can be something close to spiritual. In this concluding volume, Elena, who narrates, returns to Naples as a successful writer, but finds herself again assuming the role of sidekick to brilliant, undereducated Lila, said Maureen Corrigan in NPR.org. The friends raise their children together, but the rivalry between them never dies. And after Elena breaks a vow and writes a novel about Lila, Lila breaks off contact and vanishes. The book's conclusion masterfully returns to the opening moments of the first novel, revealing depths we couldn't initially imagine. Brava, Elena Ferrante, whoever you are. And as a dissent, compared with the earlier books, the three-decade-long story in this finale feels more roughly sketched, said Claire Massoud in the Financial Times. On the business page, the news at a glance, the economy. The Fed finally hikes interest rates. It's the end of an era at the Federal Reserve, said John Hilzenrath in the Wall Street Journal. The central bank announced this week that it's raising the benchmark interest rate, which has been near zero since 2008 financial crisis, by 0.25 percentage points. Though modest, the increase is significant because it's the first since 2006. Thus ends a period of extraordinary policy experimentation that has yielded mixed results. Cheap borrowing cost helped fuel an economic expansion now 78 months old, with none of the damaging inflation Fed critics feared. But for income growth and housing, the recovery has been extraordinarily slow. The interest rate hike is one of the most anticipated economic events in years. But ordinary consumers won't feel the impact for some time, said Tara Siegel Bernard in the New York Times. The Fed is expected to raise the federal funds rate very gradually to about 1% by the end of next year. In the short term, that rate has only a wobbly effect on how financial institutions price their products. Savings accounts and certificates of deposit should fetch slightly higher yields, but returns will still be meager. Borrowing costs for credit cards and other loans should tick up only slightly. In a section called Farewell, we have a review of the folks who died in 2015, and we'll scan through the categories and pick up a few of them. Media and publishing. Colleen McCullough, Australian author of The Thorn Birds, died January 29th, age 77. Bob Simon, Emmy-winning CBS correspondent who covered wars, protest, and crises in 67 countries, age 73. Mary Ellen Mark, photojournalist who captured society's outcasts. E.L. Doctorow, whose novels Ragtime and Billy Bathgate reimagined historical events, died July 21st at age 84. Wayne Dyer, self-help guru and author of Your Erroneous Zones, died August 29th, age 75. Jackie Collins, novelist and who chronicled the sex lives of the rich and fabulous, died September 19th, age 77. From the stage and screen, Rod Taylor, Australian actor tormented by avian attackers in The Birds, died January 7th at age 84. Leonard Nimoy, actor, director, and musician who played Star Trek's highly logical Mr. Spock, died February 27th, age 83. Omar Sharif, Egyptian actor who smoldered in Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago, died July 10th, also age 83. Joan Leslie, the girl next door movie star of Hollywood's golden age, died October 12th, age 90. Maureen O'Hara, Irish-born actress who specialized in feisty heroines, died October 24th at age 95. Robert Loggia, versatile character actor who starred in Scarface and Big, died December 4th, age 85. The music and the arts, Percy Sledge, singer of the wedding favorite When a Man Loves a Woman, died April 14th, age 74. B.B. King, Grammy-winning blues singer and guitarist, died May 14th, age 89. Paul Prudhomme, Louisiana chef who took Cajun cuisine into the mainstream, died October 8th, age 75. Cynthia Robinson, trumpeter and co-founder of Sly and the Family Stone, died November 23rd, age 71. In politics, Mario Cuomo, three-time New York governor and progressive hero who flirted with a presidential run, died January 1st, age 82. Joseph Bo Biden, son of Vice President Joe Biden and former State Attorney General of Delaware, died May 30th, age 46. Julian Bond, charismatic civil rights champion and Georgia State Senator who later headed the NAACP, died August 15th, age 75. Fred Thompson, former U.S. Senator, law and order actor, and Republican presidential candidate, died November 1st, age 73. In sports, Ernie Banks, power-hitting Chicago shortstop known as Mr. Cub, died January 23rd, age 83. Charlie Sifford, cigar-chomping golfer who was the first black member of the PGA Tour, died February 3rd, age 92. Dean Smith, basketball coach who led the University of North Carolina team for 36 years, died February 7th, age 83. Frank Gifford, former New York Giant and longtime play-by-play voice of Monday Night Football, died August 9th, age 84. And Yogi Berra, New York Yankee Hall of Fame catcher, whose unwittingly witty epigrams turned him into an American cultural icon, died September 22nd, age 90. In the business category, Gary Dahl, Adman, who invented the pet rock and became a millionaire, died March 23rd, age 78. Jean Nidek, New York housewife who tackled her own obesity and then co-founded Weight Watchers, died April 29th, age 91. Bert Shavitz, eccentric co-founder of Burt's Bees skincare products, died July 5th, age 80. Daryl Winfield, real cowboy who appeared in the Marlboro Man cigarette ads, died January 12th, age 85. In the general category, Jenny Walinda, high wire performer and matriarch of Daredevil aerialist family, the Flying Walindas, died April 4th, age 87. John Nash, Nobel Prize-winning mathematician whose descent into and recovery from mental illness inspired the film A Beautiful Mind, died May 23rd, age 86. And Jerry Parr, the quick-thinking Secret Service agent who saved President Ronald Reagan during a 1981 assassination attempt, died October 9th, age 85. Here's a short from the It Must Be True, the best of the tabloids in 2015. Trendy adults in Brooklyn are reliving their childhood at the world's first preschool for grown-ups. Preschool Mastermind charges up to $999 for a five-week course in which adults play dress-up, sing Wheels on the Bus, and make Play-Doh sculptures. The attendees include photographers, teachers, and corporate lawyers. It sounded so freeing to go play and not deal with adult problems, said pupil Sarah Fader, 35, a CEO. And we'll wind up with a quote from George Orwell. Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidarity to pure win. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.